This is a Digital Music Trance, episode 140 on the 10th of July 2013. This week on the show we discuss Shazam's new round, Daisy and AT&T, YouTube and Vivo, and much, much more. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trance, the weekly show where we chat about and try to make sense of the week's news in the digital music industry. So DMT is available on many different channels as both audio and video, and you'll find it on iTunes, most podcatchers, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud and Stitcher, as well as many more different channels across the web. So you can subscribe to the YouTube channel on youtube.com/digitalmusictrance. And this week I would like to extend my thanks to Venture Harbor, which is a company that is doing some SEO improvements on DMT, and those should be reflected in the next couple of weeks. Venture Harbor works on content marketing, search marketing, including SEO consultancy, social marketing design, and more. So check them out on ventureharbor.com. And now it's time to introduce this week's guests. And they've all been on the show before, which is great news. So it means that I haven't really scared people away yet. And we start by introducing Sitar Telli, a managing partner at Connected Venture, which is a venture capital firm focusing on seed and early stage investments based in London. So hi, Sitar, and great to have you on. How's it going? Awesome, great to have you. And on the show with us today, I'm also happy to welcome Steve Knopper, author, business news reporter for Rolling Stone magazine and freelance writer. So hi, Steve, and awesome to have you back. Thank you.
Yes, thanks for having me again.
And finally, great to welcome back to the show Nick Osterbach, founder of Sari Music, a company that specializes in digital marketing for small to medium-sized companies and management companies especially. So hey, Nick, how's it going today?
Hey, all good here. Thanks awesome. For having me.
It's great to have you. So we are going to start today by talking about a round of funding. So there's a couple of funding stories today. So it's great to have Sitar actually on board for the show. And we can talk about it. And Shazam has closed a round of funding worth $40 million thanks to the backing of Carlos Slim, the world's richest man, according to Forbes, valued at $73 billion. And the investment comes from one of Slim's companies, which is a Mexican mobile operator, America Movil, which actually constitutes the bulk of his fortune. And Shazam now counts roughly 350 million users worldwide and is responsible for around $300 million in digital goods sales. And its tight iOS integration with iTunes makes it very easy for people to buy goods when they find them on Shazam. But of course, the service is available across all sorts of different platforms. And of course, one of the core interests of Shazam in the last year or so has been to integrate with TVs, and they have done a fantastic deals with the Grammy Academy and with the Academy Awards, and they've also worked in advertising a lot, and so another big field of expansion for the company. So this is an interesting development because Shazam's CEO actually said that they didn't need the money, but it could prove really fruitful because America Movil counts around 260 million subscribers in Latin America, and the investment is a real validation of the Shazam model in the sense that somebody like Carlos Slim to invest in a company means that he believes that there is a solid business model behind it. So first of all, how do you see this new development shape the future of the company in terms of emerging markets, first of all, and also the way in which digital purchases are actually happening on mobile in these particularly emerging markets in South America and in Asia. So Sitar, start with you.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say I was surprised. I mean, I think geographic expansion is what's left for Shazam, as it's already expanded its content areas.
Yeah.
But music remains its single biggest area, and I think it's still what the company's best known for. I was a bit surprised at South America only because I don't know what actual purchase rates for music are in a lot of the countries in South America.
Yeah.
I don't know, and I don't think the problem there has been ease of use and the lack of integration with the great phone platform. I think the problem has been a financial problem. Yep. In that most of the countries don't have the economic resources to spend money on music. So I was a bit surprised. Also, I think Shazam has been most successful on iPhone.
Yeah.
And I believe, if I don't know if this is still true, but I know as of a few months ago, Brazil had the single most expensive iPhone in the world.
Yeah, it's not particularly adopted there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few people with it. And it's actually the only place where I've seen a completely fake iPhone in the wild lots of times. It looks the same. The software is terrible. But yeah, so I was surprised at their choice of market.
Because
I mean, at the company at this stage, they really need to be thinking about revenue expansion in relation to geographic expansion.
Exactly, and you know, the company is going to be battling between its of course affiliate revenues, which even with the $300 million worth of sales, actually are a relatively small amount, and the much bigger income that it can derive from partnership with the Grammys and with the Academy Awards. And for example, at the Super Bowl earlier this year, the ad by the fast food chain Jack in the Box led, you know, that company to have the most mobile engaged advert during the show. And so that was a big win for Shazam, because they were a big part of that advert in terms of integration. So so all those things probably amount to a lot more money for them than the actual affiliate revenues that they get from the sale of digital goods. So Steve, how do you see Shazam's relationship evolve in terms of affiliate revenues versus corporate clients, for example? Do you think affiliates are going to still play a big part for them?
I don't really have too much to add to this. I'm not a huge expert on the South American market, frankly. But I mean, the only thing I would add to what Sitar said is that Shazam is aggressively trying to expand it. I mean, I think you're right that the core is still music and music identification and the the interaction with download stores such as iTunes. But I think that Shazam has been quite clear that they would like to expand into TV and advertising and really bump up their revenue in that direction.
Yeah.
So that's all I can really add to it. I can't really tell you what the advertising market and the TV market is like in South America.
Absolutely, yeah, sure.
But I would just imagine that their idea is, hey, here's a whole bunch of new people that we could get beyond what they have already. So that's my somewhat uneducated look at that.
So Nikkei, what are your thoughts on Shazam? And we're talking about, before the Skype broke down completely, we're talking about the fact that the company has now a choice whether to go after big corporate clients, of course, for the advertising and for the corporate world, like, for example, the Academy Awards, or to go for more granular, for example, campaigns that it could do with smaller bands, for example. Do you see a value there for Shazam to provide some sort of services of this kind?
Yeah, well, I think like the basic points kind of came through that like it's a natural time for Shazam to be expanding.
Yeah.
And why not Latin America? And doing that with a partner, it's more strategic than actually about like trying to make money or give equity away in their service.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it all makes sense. And like, you know, as it's been for a long time, like the long-term strategy for Shazam is in advertising and kind of being like a library for fingerprinting in TV, wherever else, in anywhere, basically.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
You know, that those are the kind of two areas, I think, where they're going to be kind of trying to figure out, like, where should the business go?
Yeah. We're going to move on to talk about Project Daisy, which is something that we haven't talked about in a few weeks on the show, actually, because they've kind of gone quiet since announcing that the service was going to happen a few months ago. The service is due to start operating probably in Q3, Q4 of this year. The company, of course, is backed by Jimmy Iovine from Beats by Dr. Dre, and is looking, apparently, to strike a deal with a mobile carrier. So that makes a lot of sense. AT&T apparently is in the picture, and this would allow the service to ramp up its user base super quickly without having to go through, you know, millions of dollars of marketing spend or doing too much work on that front, because of course AT&T would grant them a huge user base from the get-go. So first of all, you know, where do you see Daisy being in terms of the negotiating position? Like, do you think that AT&T has got a stronger position in the sense that it can offer Daisy this huge platform, or does the association with Beats by Dr. Dre actually, or is that strong enough by itself to actually carry the service and help it strike a decent deal with one of these operators? Steve, what's your take on that from a US perspective?
I feel like AT&T could walk away from this deal easier than Daisy and Beats could. I mean, I unless I'm missing something, like obviously, you know, Beats has been a very successful company. The people behind it, Jimmy Iovine and Ian Rogers, really good people. And you know, I imagine that when their service finally does roll out, it'll be something interesting, something cool. But right now, it's just sort of hard to conceptualize. There's so many really strong players in the space. You know, why would I want to do Beats' streaming service when I have Spotify or Moog or RDO or Songs or, you know, whatever else it is, plus buying stuff on iTunes. It just seems crowded.
Yeah.
So I guess that'd be my feeling about it. I feel like it would be a hard sell to take this sort of vague, yeah, we're going to do this great service kind of thing to a major company like AT&T. However, I'm not privy to all the details, I'm sure, and Jimmy Iovine is a much better and more experienced deal maker than I am. So,
yeah, sure. Nick, looking at this potential deal, you know, we look back at what has happened in the streaming space to other companies like Spotify, for example, which has made successful deals, for example, in Germany with the carrier there and a few other countries, but it hasn't really managed to land a major carrier deal in the US. And some blame it on the fact that it's, you know, a brand recognition problem, because Spotify is still in its, you know, it's growing, but it's still not a major company in terms of being recognizable. How do you feel about AT&T choosing a newcomer like Daisy instead of somebody like Spotify in the US to come into the market with a streaming service offering?
Yeah, well, I think, like, from my point of view, when Beats and those guys, like, when they bought MOG, MOG yeah. didn't have any technology that was superior to their competitors. It was basically falling back with the race.
Yeah.
And now, like, after since Jimmy Iovine, or however you say his name, he got in board, like, there's been a very good PR effort on, like, you know, how Daisy will be this, you know, like, direct-to-fan kind of different version and kind of a more the kind of a topspin angle of how you're connecting the fans direct to the streaming space. Yeah. But, like, so far, we haven't seen any features that would, like, you know, put them ahead of their competition. I think, like, something they've emphasized a lot is curation and the importance of curation. But then also I would argue that, like, you know, if you're trying to build a global service, how do you do curation? Yep. Wouldn't you then need some kind of mechanical curation with human curation? And then that being said, Spotify's kind of recommendation features are actually pretty good. And I think, like, you know, they have a lot of work to do to be able to compete with Spotify and RDO.
Absolutely.
And currently they're falling behind, and there's just this big promise of, like, this new service. But a lot of the hype comes from, like, the people involved. So I think, like, they have to deliver on, you know, what they're promising.
Yeah.
And hopefully we're going to see something concrete soon and not just talk.
Exactly. And Sitar, that makes a really good point, because you've worked with a lot of early stage companies and saw them through to launch. And so how do you feel about the tactic of hyping up the company so much from the get-go? Is it incredibly dangerous to create the image of this, like, really cool new layout, new way of offering the music catalog type idea when we don't really know if the company is going to be able to deliver? And if it can't deliver to the standard that it promised, then it's going to be seen as a failure, even if it is a decent service.
I usually find that tactic fairly dangerous. And I don't know that there's a lot of benefit to it, although I think Topspin, Ian's previous company, took the same route.
Yeah.
And again, I think it was a dangerous route for them, because they ended up under-delivering a lot initially, especially on the self-service marketing bit of it. So I'm surprised they went down the same route again. Then again, with the people involved, I'm not sure you could have done this in a stealth manner.
Yeah.
You know, there's some pretty big names, so I'm not sure they had a choice about it. Also, I think, you know, the Beats, it is quite a good technical product, the headphones, but it's also brilliant marketing.
Yeah.
And I don't know that they would have chosen any other route. And then in terms of whether there's really an opportunity for them, you know, if you were to say all people want is just access to all music, then I would say no, because I think you can already get that. Not even on Spotify, frankly, most people get it on YouTube, which is the single biggest music provider in the world. But actually, the problem isn't that. The problem is one of user experience. And the Spotify user experience has changed in about 5 years. you know, it's an incredibly dated user experience. And some of the stuff they've released recently, especially with Discovery, I think is moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
But if Daisy has any opportunity, it'll be, I think, in providing just a much better user experience for people, particularly around playlisting, which is, I think, an area where Spotify just hasn't done nearly as much as they could have.
Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense. But also, like, one of the things that I was thinking is, of course, it makes sense for them to have started with this huge, you know, bombastic type of campaign on the fact that they're going to be the best service out there if they want to land a carrier service like that, because then they already have the hype, and then it's a chip in their pool to be able to play with somebody like AT&T to say, look, we've already had all this press, everybody's excited about it. If you do a deal with us, then people are going to be excited about it, they're going to report it, they're going to talk about it and all that. So maybe that's another reason why they decided to go for the sort of all-out we're going to be the best type scenario.
Well, the other, I think, angle to that is, I think Beats has generally a very positive sentiment amongst consumers.
Yeah.
I don't think AT&T does. Just guessing that AT&T does not. And it could be that AT&T also just wants that brand association.
Yeah, would make a lot of sense. And talking about YouTube, like you mentioned just a second ago, there's a very interesting story that actually was from last week, but I didn't manage to talk about it last week because the show ran long, as usual. And it's the fact that YouTube and Vivo have finally announced a renewal of the deal, and that deal had expired actually a couple of months ago, and there were debates as to whether Vivo was going to go and strike out on its own, which are probably mostly a tactic for Vivo to actually be able to get some better terms from YouTube, for example. But, you know, as far as I could see, this is an inevitable renewal in the sense that Vivo needs YouTube to get the majority of its traffic, and YouTube needs Vivo in terms of the premium content that it can bring to the platform and the huge artists that it has on board. And so, you know, according to the Financial Times, Google will actually be investing in Vivo to the sum of $40 to $50 million, which translates to about a 7% stake in the company. And you know, this kind of seems to seal the partnership off for good as a long-term one, especially if they have a stake in the company now. So I can't see them separating, you know, Vivo from YouTube anytime soon. So what do you think about you know, the renewal? Of course, you probably find that it's inevitable like I did, but do you think that Vivo had any chance of surviving a spinning off YouTube? And who would have been damaged the most, YouTube or Vivo, from an eventual breakup of the conversation on that front? Steve, do you have any points on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my only point would be the simple point that that I think Vivo and YouTube are pretty linked. I think for Vivo to try to make it on its own as a standalone or working with some other company, I think would be a real stretch for them. So yeah, basically, I mean, I think that this investment, this deal between YouTube and Vivo is a survival thing for Vivo. I think Vivo does bring some value to YouTube. But certainly YouTube could survive without Vivo fairly well. Yeah. It would be missing some content, certainly a lot of Universal stuff, and other partnership stuff, other content stuff with labels. But, you know, I think this partnership works for both of them.
And Nikkei, what's your take on that? Do you think that Vivo had any other options as far as distribution? And in that sense, do you think that maybe it's too tightly tied to Google, even if it is supposedly a separate company?
Yeah, well, I think like with Vivo, with like I think 70% plus traffic coming from YouTube search, they were always like linked in with YouTube quite, you know, deeply. So I don't know, like, you know, when there were like this kind of talks about, you know, like maybe striking a partnership with Facebook or something, that could probably be facilitated, but like, you know, it would have to be like, you know, kind of reinventing how they do business.
Yeah.
Because as far as I know, everything from insights into how videos go in, like, you know, so much is using the YouTube infrastructure that, like, you know, what has Vivo ever been more than like a curational layer on top of YouTube from one point of view?
Yeah.
So I think, like, you know, it would have been a very, you know, it would have been a massive change, and they would have kind of had to start from scratch.
Yeah.
And something I thought today is that probably the insights tools, like all their insights, is also probably using YouTube infrastructure. So I don't know where would that leave with, like, you know, them being able to take that content and being able to make smart marketing decisions or curational decisions with that content without the insight element. But yeah. I'm 100% sure about that.
Yeah.
But then I think, like, with Google investing into Vivo, I think that that's, as Steve said, like, it's, you know, it's an example of, like, it's a token of that, like, you know, they're going to be working together and kind of to deepen the partnership and take it onto that level. And I think Vivo will keep on going as it's been going the last few years, and it will be a big, important music destination. The bigger change I see is what's going to happen between managers and, like, are they going to allow their videos to go on Vivo? Or, I mean, right. Like, you know, if there's an artist manager or an artist who create content and they want to develop their own YouTube channel, that can be in conflict with their label agreement and videos going up on Vivo.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, usually how it works is, like, who pays the bills, they put the asset wherever they want to. But, like, there's a big shift coming now between managers and labels, is that, like, if you need to be developing your own YouTube channel, or if you need to be in control of your own assets, where does Vivo fit into that mix?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And Sitar, do you think that, you know, the 7% or so, you know, whatever percentage it is that now Google owns of Vivo, does that, you know, ensure essentially that Vivo won't be able to play this card again in terms of, you know, getting voices, for example, you know, like the rumors that circulated that it would perhaps separate it as a different company? And does that sort of limit the potential negotiating power of Vivo in respect to its biggest business partner, essentially?
Don't know. I mean, 7% doesn't seem like a big enough stake.
Yeah.
To be able to, but then again, you know, you can negotiate a small equity stake and very strong rights associated with it, and a lot of times corporates do.
Yeah.
So, and I don't believe the investment came from Google Ventures, did it? It came from the Google.
Yeah.
Came from Google as a company, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it the precursor to an acquisition. So I don't think they're going to do that. I'm not entirely sure what the terms of it are, other than to give, you know, in fact, the rest of the deal is a revenue share between the two companies, right? So this would just be a way for Vivo to get some funding in, I guess, to run operations without having to split it back to Google.
Yeah.
I don't know how much it really limits what. Actually, a better way to say it, I don't think the equity stake limits it nearly as much as Vivo's total dependency on YouTube limits it.
Yeah, sure. And staying on that subject, actually, I'll stay with you for a second, talking about MCNs. So Base79 raised a new round of an amount undisclosed. So one of the biggest multi-channel networks on YouTube. It had a 10 million round back in November, and now the new round comes from Evolution Media Growth Partners. So,
yeah.
Of course, it's one of the biggest channels on YouTube. It's got over 650 million views per month. And, you know, actually, in the interest of full disclosure, actually, the Digital Music Trends is going to be on Base79 at some point soon, in the next couple of weeks or so. But you know, what I'm wondering is also for those channels, like for Vivo, there is a huge dependency on YouTube, and you know, in business, we're always sort of told that don't put all your eggs in one basket when it comes to only having essentially one source of income. And all these companies are really depending on YouTube so heavily for their income. Do you think they have any chance of spinning out into their own separate ventures, or is that just going to be the way that it is, and they're going to have to carry on with this complete dependency on Google, essentially? What do you reckon on that?
I think it's like, well, I don't know Base79 well enough, I guess, to comment on them specifically. I think for any kind of content network, in order for them to have any kind of independency, they need to be a bit like maybe College Humor is, and build a brand around their content that's so strong that they become a destination site in their own right. But I mean, Base79's strategy hasn't been that, at least from what I read. It's been instead to just acquire content and use Google as distribution. And it could be that that's just more efficient or economical for them than trying to build their own brand. Although it could be that the name change to Base79 it's probably the first step what was it before? It was Video Rights, My Video Rights. It was a terrible brand. So it could be that the rebrand is just a first step to them eventually creating their own brand, which is a destination site people go to. The problem is their videos don't have a tight, coherent theme around them the way, say, College Humors does or some other video destination sites do. And I think unless you're creating those kinds of brands, it's difficult to become a direct site versus you have to rely on YouTube.
Yeah. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about this week, which is slightly techy, but it's quite interesting in terms of looking at how companies are placing themselves on the digital music space online, is looking at the new Firefox mobile operating system. So the system has gone on sale in Spain already. It was announced not such a long time ago, really. And it relies completely on open standards, like Firefox does. It relies on HTML5 for all its applications. And so the aim is for Mozilla to break down the garden walls that are currently rising higher and higher when it comes to mobile operating systems. And so the music angle is that 7Digital jumped on board from the get-go to provide users with access to its catalog and the ability to buy music on their devices. And of course, this is a very, very small market right now, made of a few people that are going to buy, or maybe lots of people are going to buy this in Spain, and enthusiasts that are using it on Raspberry Pis and maybe hack their Android phones to run it. But it could actually see a wider release, especially if the prices are kept as low as they have been in Spain. I think it's on sale outright for only about like 70 or 80 euros or something around those lines. And so what are your thoughts, Steve, on having another party added to the equation? And also, do you think that it is conceivable to have a leg up in an environment like that when there are so many different services, and perhaps 7Digital really thought it's a good idea to be the first person to jump on the ship, and perhaps users will take notice and will start actually buying tracks on the service, as it's really the only way to access music right now on those phones?
I mean, 7Digital is interesting. It's a very crowded marketplace, and you got iTunes and Amazon and all these other players that are actually kind of dominating it. 7Digital is trying to find these very specific niches in territorially and also with devices. And they're getting a foothold and they're doing a pretty good job of finding those niches. And so maybe they'll just continue to survive with those niches. So that would be fine. Whether they're going to be a more dominant player and compete with iTunes, I think it's probably.
Yeah, sure. And Sitar, for you, do you think it's a good strategy to be present? I know 7Digital is one of the companies that has the most presence on different operating systems on mobile, and we're seeing more and more companies launch their apps on Windows Mobile, for example. How important is it to be present right from the get go on a system like that, in case that it takes off?
What we advise most of our investments to do is focus on the core platforms where you think there's the biggest audience.
Yeah.
And from that perspective, I wouldn't ever suggest one of our companies focus on Firefox OS. Yeah. In fact, what we generally advise them is it's iOS and it's Android. And that's pretty much it. And even to stay away from Windows. And for most startups and even mid-sized companies, a platform is extremely hard. Two platforms is just an order of complexity much, much higher. And every time you add a platform, it just becomes harder and harder and harder. And in terms of complexity, I think iOS is probably the simplest.
Yeah.
The others I don't know about. And I know what Mozilla has been pushing quite a bit is the fact that it's an HTML5 one. So you don't have to build something new, but actually most websites aren't really built for access on mobile.
Yeah.
they don't really scale down for it. And so I think it would require development to be a super mobile HTML5 friendly site. And I don't know that that's most people's core focus today either.
Yeah.
And most startups focus at least initially.
Sure. I wanted to continue on the show by talking about Jay-Z and his release saga, because that's really one of the most interesting stories of the last few weeks. We've been talking about it almost every week since it began. And this week, of course, the RIAA yesterday ruled that the release is already platinum after changing its own rules to scrap the 30-day wait that was required even from digital album releases. And of course, deciding to count the Samsung sales as part of the platinum certification. So now the record is platinum. And there was also a very interesting article from John Perlis on the New York Times talking about the security implications of the Jay-Z app on Samsung. So that brings up some really important points to do with the giveaway itself and how that might work out for other artists as well. So according to Perlis, the application required to download the Magna Carta Holy Grail asks for, number one, permission to read the phone's status and identity. It will also gather the accounts, so the email addresses and the social media usernames connected to the phone. It also asks users to log into either Facebook or Twitter to allow the app to post. And finally, every single time the user wanted to see the lyrics of the song they were listening to, they were prompted to post on either Facebook or Twitter. And the post could be changed, could be edited, but they had to post something every single time they listened to a track. So this seems like a lot of work for just a release. And the New York Times wonders whether Jay-Z went from being paranoid about being watched by the feds to actually being the one that's snooping around in people's phones. So I want to ask you, is this a necessary price to be paid for a free piece of content that would have probably cost you $8 if you were to buy it on iTunes? Are they asking you for too much information? And do people care? I mean, if people are prepared to give all this information away and they don't question it, then I'm sure that other releases and other organizations are going to do exactly the same thing. So, sorry, Nick is still away, isn't he? Yeah, Sitara, what are your thoughts on this?
On the app in general? I didn't get to see the app. So
yeah.
On
the privacy implications, like on the fact that it's gathering so much data for you and all you're getting is an album, which is great, but it's an $8 purchase, and if you have to surrender everything about you in order to get it, then it becomes like a different conversation, doesn't it?
Well, from a pure human psychological standpoint, people surrender information for a lot less, like 3 pence. So I'm not surprised that people do it. What I'm more concerned with is, when I read the article, what concerned me more was that they asked for all of these things in a way that just seemed like a terrible user experience.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably going to affect whether this happens again more than anything else. And it's not going to be a question of, well, I'll pay the $8 or I won't. It'll be, I'll download it for free.
Yeah.
Or I won't. And I just won't go through the pain of this. And I think, the thing that Spotify did really well is it made it easier to get music legally than illegally.
Yeah.
And this app feels like a step back from that for consumers. So, if it had really been, a million Samsung users get the album for free, and that had been it, and they just relied on people to share the album because they liked it, that would have been great.
Yeah.
I think forcibly doing it is the bigger issue. The privacy stuff, I don't know. I don't think about it as much only because I think people have given access to that stuff so often.
Yeah.
And they oftentimes don't realize they're doing it. So that seems more like
a good
newspaper article than anything else. The bigger issue it raised for me is that it just seems like a step back for an album release in terms of just making it really easy for fans to access music.
Yeah, and Steve, what's the perspective from the US? Have you seen the app at all? And what's the reaction been so far? People that you work with at Rolling Stone or elsewhere?
So, yeah, I mean, I guess my feeling about the I actually haven't seen the app itself, although I've seen, obviously, screen grabs and a lot of really thorough detail about what's in it and so forth. I guess my feeling about the privacy thing is that I do think that there's a little bit more to the privacy issue beyond just the user experience, although I agree with you, Sitar, about that, especially in the wake of these NSA allegations and you know all this information that's coming out that says the government in the U.S. is specifically getting information from major companies like Facebook and Google and using this information for God knows what purpose. It seems like to come out and have privacy be an issue for you now is at the very least a PR problem. And also the idea that, well, we're just doing what everybody else does, only in a more obvious way, in a more blatant way that everyone can see, you know, I'm not sure that that is a huge defense. I feel like Jay-Z as an artist, and especially someone who has dealt with these privacy issues in the past, you know, although, you know, his lyrics are more in the context of sort of, hey, I'm a drug dealer, feds, get off my case, you know, kind of thing is often the context in his lyrics. But still, as Pareles in the New York Times mentioned, that is a theme that's gone through his music. I mean, I think he's someone who can sort of come out and be proactive on this issue. And at least that's what my sources are telling me.
Yeah.
And in fact, Jay-Z, you know, he did this Twitter Q&A the other day, and there were a million questions for him. And he actually did sort of respond to the tweet about this privacy stuff and suggest that he was conciliatory. He suggested, I forget his exact wording, but it was sort of like, that sucks, we'll do better next time.
Yeah.
So, do you think he didn't know? It sounds like he didn't know.
Well, I mean, I think his Twitter response was four words, so you kind of have to intuit what he said based on that.
Yeah.
My guess, and what sources are speculating to me, is that, yeah, he didn't know that, either he didn't know about the privacy thing, or he didn't suspect that it would blow up into this public relations black eye that it's kind of become for him. And as Sitar suggests, I mean, it's not just the privacy thing. It's also that there were technical glitches and people had trouble downloading the app and they were turning their phones on and off a million times and shutting down the service. And I guess, and sources are sort of suggesting this too, but it seems like this is a bigger PR black eye for Samsung than it is for Jay-Z. I mean, you would imagine that it sort of reminds me of a couple years ago when Ticketmaster just said, we're gonna merge with Live Nation, everybody should agree to this merger.
Yeah.
And the very next thing that happened was this thing about how, you know, there was this fish thing where all these fish tickets were, there was a big problem in people getting on the Ticketmaster site and it froze, and then there's an issue with Springsteen. And so, you know, if you're a tech company and you're showing, I have the juice to compete in this space with major, major artists, music world, you got to get it right.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
sure.
So I feel like that's sort of more, I would say that's kind of the overwhelming issue more than anything else, although I wouldn't necessarily dismiss the privacy stuff. I think, you know, all the privacy things are buried in these terms and conditions that we all blindly sign.
Of course.
And I think that that's gonna be an issue moving forward, especially if we see more issues like Prism and NSA and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. And then Nika, to bring him back in, I wanted to ask, what's your take on this? You know, do you think artists have to be mindful, especially if there's a big name, to as to how the data that is collected about their user, the fans, is also stored and used, and how the user experience of the apps that they put out is, because of course that really reflects on the brand name as well in the end.
Yeah. So basically, like there's a lot of conversations now about like pre-release strategies and like, you know, how should you do them, where do you do them. And basically, like in an ideal world, obviously you would go with a partner where all of your fans can access the music, but then that's your own website in a way. So like that comes back to the argument of like, you know, the whole idea of like user experience being so bad in Jay-Z's case is that like you can argue that one thing he didn't do, or his crew didn't do well, is give his fans the best, easiest way to access his new album. I think this was the opposite. So, I mean, like, from a fan point of view, this wasn't a good thing. From a financial point of view, I'm sure it was a very good thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, as Steve said, like, it's not very good PR for Samsung, as like, you know, that they can't, you know, release you know, this kind of a simple app like this.
Yeah, yeah. So, of course. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And hopefully, you know, that this will be an interesting lesson for any other artist that is looking at doing this, because of course this is, we have to remember that this is really the first instance of such a big giveaway being done in this way as a pre-release and under this term. Yeah. So hopefully like artists and companies that are working on this on this field are going to look at how this worked out, what didn't work, what worked, and perhaps provide a better customer experience when the next one comes around. And you know, these albums releases don't come around every day, so I would imagine that even if it takes off as a practice, we wouldn't see more than maybe 4 or 5 a year of this kind.
It's also to be said, like, you know, if the app was performing that badly, I'm not sure, like, you know, I don't think there's, like, you know, the half of, you know, CIA's technical, you know, intelligence machinery plugged into that app. So, you know, yeah, exactly. I really don't think, like, you know, that data is going to be used in any way, you know, like that there's so little focus on like simple email marketing sometimes with major artists. Like, I really don't think, like, you know, it's some sort of a, you know, data capture exercise, at least to the extent of, like, you know, what's being reported.
Yeah, sure. That's cool. Well, guys, I think I'm going to let you go because we had a few technical issues today and the show has ended up running long, even if we haven't recorded a huge amount. But I just wanted to run through what you guys are up to at the moment in case there's anything you can or want to talk about or plug. So, Nikkei, on your front?
I mean, you know, we kind of covered the more kind of the fan-facing conversations here. Something about, like you said, about Pandora and their PR problem, you know, what we would have discussed later on. But, like, something that has to be said about that debate, I think, is that I wish there would be more kind of conversations on kind of, making sure that you also discuss traditional radio every time you blame Pandora on bad payments.
Yeah.
Because, like, surely that's the future. So, I mean, Pandora should be paying more. That's my personal opinion. But then again, like, shouldn't traditional radio be paying more? So why are these, why is everyone after Pandora? Because, like, if Pandora would, disappear somewhere, like that's such a huge, like, you know, engaged music, you know, database of fans engaging with internet radio. So I hope, like, you know, there's a future for Pandora, so that, like, everyone's happy and there's going to be bigger payments.
Yeah, absolutely. And Steve, on your front, anything you're working on that you wanna mention?
Just the usual stuff. I'm kind of deep into covering this. Actually, it's good timing, this story with Jay-Z and Samsung right now for Rolling Stone.
Right.
So thanks, actually, Sitar. Some of the stuff that you said in particular was helpful. But in addition to that, don't worry, it's off the record. But in addition to that, I just wanted to let people know that I am actually working on a biography of Michael Jackson that will come out in 2015. So it's a little bit of a departure from what I usually write about, but pretty exciting, pretty complex for the research.
Absolutely, and it's one of those projects that, yeah, if it spans a couple of years, it's really a big one.
Yes, I hope so. We'll see. I got to finish it first.
Absolutely. And Sitar, anything your end? I know that you're now working with a few companies there, but I don't think you can talk about any of them yet. So I guess
not yet. But none are actually in the music space.
Right.
So if there's anyone listening or watching that's doing something interesting in music that isn't streaming, or discovery. definitely get in touch if you're not in one of those areas.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. Well, thanks so much, guys, for joining me.
Thank you
very much. Okay. Guys.
And as you may have noticed, this week we had a couple of technical issues on the video front, which prevented us from running through all of the news that I was hoping to get to. But here is a quick roundup of what we ended up leaving out. And first of all, Songkick last week opened up the tour to a number of new cities in the UK, including Birmingham, Brighton, Bristol, Cardiff, Coventry, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Manchester, Nottingham and Sheffield. So we talked about the tour a few times on the show, a service that lets fans pledge to buy a ticket for an artist's show, which, if there are enough pledges, then can actually become a reality, and also can it can help artists and promoters gauge the size of the venue needed. So the big question mark we left with a few weeks ago when we spoke last about Detour is the fact that there's a big organizational element in getting these gigs off the ground, which could make the expansion of the project rather slow and not without hiccups. But the company, as reported by The Guardian, is partnered with a few promoters, including DHP, for example, and it's feasible that they're going to be able to organize these promoters so that the gigs are actually happen in a relatively smooth fashion. And there were a couple of stories this week on Windows Mobile, so I thought it deserved a shout out for once. The first is about Bing Audio, a service that I knew nothing about until I came across a post on the Windows blog. So Bing Audio apparently offers the same functionality as a Shazam or a SoundHound, but is built into the search screen for Windows 8 mobile devices in the US. And the feature is now being rolled out to many more countries internationally. So the Bing Audio service is tied to the Microsoft Xbox Music streaming service, and it will allow users to add the tracks they looked up into their Xbox Music library, so that's quite a cool tie-up. And the other interesting bit of news about Windows 8 is that Spotify released an updated version of its mobile application, as reported by The Verge, which improves the app and brings in some much-needed functionality, like being able to fast-forward through a track, which, believe it or not, wasn't available beforehand. So even though these are two different stories, one of internal and one of external development, it's interesting to note that things are moving on the Windows Mobile and Windows 8 fronts. And now it's time to talk about the world news, and it seems like this could be a regular segment on Digital Music Trends in the future. And the first up, we have a story from a Business Inquiry from the Philippines, and the Philippine long-distance telephone company and Universal Music have struck a deal that will allow the carrier's mobile units to distribute the label's music. Through Smart Music, more than 70 million subscribers will have access to more than 3 million tracks under the Universal Music Group umbrella. And the deal allows Universal Music to expand its business in the Philippines, which has nearly 100% mobile penetration. And it cuts losses in piracy, and it also undercuts the price charged by iTunes in the country by more than half, which is another interesting move. On top of that, Smart Music downloads can be charged against a prepaid or postpaid billing, removing the need for a credit card, which is also a big plus in this sort of markets and scenarios. So this is a very exciting stuff, but also I would love to know whether the terms of the deal allow for the carrier to strike similar partnerships with the other labels and other majors as well, or if this is an exclusive type of scenario. And after that, we talk about South Africa, where the music retail chain Look and Listen, which has 28 physical stores in the country, has announced a partnership with Mondia Media, which will allow it to relaunch its digital music store, a service that was halted in February, presumably due to lack of traction and high maintenance costs. The joint venture will see Mondia Media leveraging its existing partnerships with artists and labels to deliver a high-quality MP3 store for the retailer. And coming back to London via New York, Hypebot pointed me in the direction of a company called PromoHut that is actually based here in London and has launched a pre-release subscription service that allows music fans to gain early access to music directly from the labels. The project is oriented towards the electronic music scene for now, and it creates a monthly subscription that aims to monetize a system that was originally, of course, created to grant professional DJs and reviewers access to those pre-releases. And now that's been broadened to superfans, so that's got a price tag attached, and the service is not cheap, starting at $6.99 per month for one pre-release per month, or a £12.99 for four pre-releases per month, and these are delivered as high-quality MP3s. So this is an interesting way to monetize on a windowing system of sorts that is already in existence for labels when it comes to sending tracks to reviewers and DJs. And for labels that are not particularly concerned with leaks, that is definitely a really interesting path to try out. And finally, Banzoogle has acquired OneSheet. If you haven't heard of either service yet, here's what they do. So Banzoogle is a website building platform aimed specifically at bands, which provides a host of music-specific services in an easy-to-set-up package for $9.99 per month. And it already boasts thousands of artists on its platform. OneSheet, inside, is a company that lets entertainers build hassle-free websites. So, two similar companies, and Banzoogle aims to keep OneSheet as an independent product, and the company's site will be relaunched shortly. And that's all for this week. Thanks so much for tuning into the show. If you were watching the video version, apologies for the problems that we've had this week with Skype that you will have noticed if you were watching the video. Hopefully we'll have those fixed by next week, Skype permitting. Other than that, please do visit digitalmusictrends.com and also check out the One-to-One Show, which is another weekly show on the Digital Music Trends Network, where we talk about the latest startups in the digital music industry, and also I interview companies that work in the digital music space about their specific projects, which can be quite interesting. Thanks so much for listening. Again, have a great week, and until next time. And that's all for this week. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Check out digitalmusictrends.com and sign up to the weekly newsletter.